This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be looking at the situation in Germany and whether Angela Merkel can hold things together. We'll also be speaking to Norway's immigration minister and discussing the dying art of cottaging. And if you don't know what that is, stick with us to the end of the podcast. After 12 years as Germany's Chancellor, Angela Merkel is this week facing the worst crisis of her premiership. Coalition talks collapsed after the Free Democrats walked away from negotiations with Merkel's Christian Democrats. So where does this leave Germany? In the magazine this week, William Cook calls the situation uniquely damaging, while James Forsyth outlines the implications for Brexit. James joins me now, along with Thomas Kielinger, London correspondent for Die Welt. And because this podcast was recorded on Budget Day, you may be able to hear the helicopter hovering over Westminster. So James, does this spell the end of Angela Merkel's 12 years as Germany's Chancellor?
I think the election results suggest that she was coming to the end of her career. I think the British parallel I would draw is with Tony Blair's victory in 2005. He won the general election, but it was clear after that that it was never going to be glad, confident morning again, and that he was on the kind of glide path out of office. I think that's the kind of position that Angela Merkel is in now.
Thomas, can you explain for the uninitiated into German party politics how Merkel has ended up in her sort of swan song, basically?
Well, she's hoisted on the petard of German political culture, which always goes for coalition building. And with ever more parties in parliament, and with ever more of an uncertain trumpet, as it were, that the electorate sort of blow, coming up with these indecisive sort of election results, she's having to make ever more compromises. And while she's been good at doing that and steering the country clear of all internal disputes, now she's come to the end of the road because the four parties who would have made the coalition are much too difficult to sort of keep together unless you want to completely sacrifice your own profile. So that was pretty cool. And unlike Blair, by the way, to pick up James's point before, with Blair we knew at least that we would only have half a term maximum and then would pass on the baton to Gordon Brown. There's no heir apparent in Germany. That's the problem.
I mean, this is a fascinating thing because Angela Merkel has essentially, Thomas obviously knows much more about this than me, but she's essentially killed off all the potential successors
to her.
Yes.
Stole their clothes and everything.
Yeah, she's adopted a kind of King Herod strategy. So it is not clear who the alternative leader is. And now, it's only one poll, but I was very struck by a poll taken after the collapse of these Kölner talks. It shows that the combined share of the vote of the CDU and the SPD, which was already at a post-war low in the last election, is still falling. And interestingly, the Free Democrats, who have kind of violated German political culture in a way by saying, we're not going to go into government, they're going up in the polls. This suggests to me that it's not clear that another election will solve the problem. It's not clear that another election is going to provide a clear government.
The latest vibes we get from Berlin about this another election, which Merkel herself has proposed as her favourite solution, is that yes, there will be one, and there will be a new approach at the Grand Coalition building, except on one condition: no more Merkel and no more Schulz on the SPD side. So I don't think the SPD, who so far have said, no, we're not going to be in government, we're going to be in opposition, will change their mind unless the CDU produces someone else other than Merkel. They will not go into government under Merkel again.
Who do you think that could be?
Well, that is the $100 million question, really. Nobody in Germany at the moment can say that. As you said, she killed off all likely contenders. And that's the problem with people in power. They don't build for the succession because they don't want a competitor, as it were, looking over their shoulder. So leave it too late, and therefore we have nobody at the moment who is clearly the runner.
And how big a crisis, if a crisis at all, do you think this is, Thomas?
Well, it's been made up into a huge crisis by the media and the likes of us and others who like drama. But then Germany is a very stable and well-administered country. The professions will continue, tax will continue to be collected. There's no sort of unrest in the streets. So they'll just wait out and see and what happens. Basically, modern democracies can be governed without a government for a long time. They run along on autopilot, as it were. And all the major state institutions are fully functional. I mean, Holland took 5 months to have a new government. Belgium, I believe, even longer. Well, we don't want that to happen with Germany because the country wants to be able to produce a stable, strong and stable government. But it'll be some time. But in the meantime, Germany is pretty much at ease.
James, what does this mean for Germany's international position?
Yeah, to pick up on Thomas's point, I actually think the impact of Germany not having an empowered government will be bigger on the European Union than it will be on Germany. I think there are two effects. First of all, if the Germans were going to meet Emmanuel Macron's plans for Eurozone reform even halfway, they would need a chancellor with political capital to burn. They don't have that right now. Whether that's Angela Merkel or somebody else, they're not going to have that ability to meet them there. I think if you look at why the coalition collapsed, a lot of the issues are related to this. You know, one of the reasons why the FDP came back and falling below the 5% threshold was because they took this very hard line on the Eurozone. So I think that's one effect. I think it means that the kind of Macron-Juncker plans
for
European reform, they are done.
Yeah.
And then I think there is an impact on Brexit because I think with the Chancellery preoccupied, the German position on Brexit is going to default to that of the German Foreign Office, which is more federalist, more inclined to take the Commission line. And I don't think it was ever realistic to think that Angela Merkel was going to kind of ride to Theresa May's rescue. She didn't ride to David Cameron's rescue. She was never going to do that. That's not how she leads. But what it suggests is that, you know, on this extra money that the Cabinet agreed, the initial government, UK government plan was that they were going to offer this money to Tusk, Juncker, Macron and Merkel. And if all four of them agreed, they'd make the offer formal. Now, you've essentially taken Germany out of that equation right now. And I think that will make it more difficult to get progress. For example, you know, when it comes to the Irish border issue, you know, I think there was a hope on the UK government side that the bigger EU member states would come and lean on the Irish and say, look, you can't hold these talks up. I think those kind of hopes are reduced by the fact that Angela Merkel is now going to be totally preoccupied by domestic matters.
And James, with respect, I tend to slightly disagree. My reading of the situation is that it'll have a minimum impact on the negotiations because Brussels is a sort of edifice all in its own right and its own sort of power. And we already have a clear sort of timescale before us. We need to get on with it. We need to break the logjam about the cost of the separation and so forth. But that is already on the cards. It's going to happen. Britain is going to offer a better deal for the separation document. So Germany can sort of look after themselves, as it were. As you rightly said, nobody is going to be able to lean on anyone else in the community to produce a deal, least of all the Irish who have their own mind. But it'll be now in the hands of the Commission, of Barnier, Juncker, Tusk and others, and Britain, to see whether they can hammer out a compromise. I think, in a way, it's a moot point about France and Germany. I mean, who is France, after all? Who's France for Germany to lean on? It's a totally unreformed country, which is in desperate need to really modernise its own internal creaky structures. You know, it was never a sort of hope for the Germans to be close with France and usher it into a more reformist sort of mindset. Nobody is going to change the mindset of the French anyway, unless they are prepared to stop having civil wars about normal reforms in their country. So let's say these countries will have to sort of look at their own neighbours and let the rest of the negotiations with Britain continues on the Brussels-related level.
And Thomas, do you think it's fair to say that, given there are a number of other European countries with significant change or even turmoil or crisis, for instance, Spain, that there are cracks appearing in the European project more widely, not just a sort of shift in terms of German thinking about Europe?
Well, there are cracks all over, of course.
Are they serious cracks?
Well, the EU, to begin with, is by no means a safeguard of the currency. It can have new problems every moment in Greece or elsewhere. And as you said, Spain is a country in partly turmoil. But then we have already, as James said, begun to bury the idea of a sort of more integrated Europe. That is for the dreamers. We really have to make sure that individual countries manage to produce a stable and successful, economically successful societies that can get on with it. And then we will have intergovernmental relations again. I don't think the days of dreaming and talking about closer integration in Europe, we will see that in a hurry. I don't think we will. So it's the countries in concern that you say that where there are cracks, we have to make sure that they remove those cracks and produce a more cohesive society. Well, it's an uncertain world, you're quite right. Another question mark, now Germany added to it, and predictions about the future are very difficult.
James, just to ask you to make a prediction about the future, how easy is it really to remove those cracks that we've just talked about?
I think the long-term threat to the European Union is the euro, which has substantial structural flaws. I slightly disagree with Thomas in this respect, which is, if you look at what Macron is trying to do in France, you know, he is basically saying to France, here is the stick of domestic reforms that you're not going to like, but the carrot is more burden sharing, you know, common European debt and all the like. Basically,
you're not going to get German to agree with it.
I agree with that. Yeah. And that is why. But exactly, this is the crucial point. This is the fundamental instability of the European Union, which is they pushed ahead with a single currency before they had a single state. And that tension is going to continue to rub up against each other. Now, so far in the financial crises, they've got away with it. Greece was small enough. Ireland was small enough. These aren't trivial things. But if a major economy got into trouble, like, for example, France, that would be far more Italy, difficult to deal with. How do they do that? Italy, I think, is a fascinating point. You know, in Italy, if you do the maths, you can put together a coalition of, consistently in the polls, over 50% of the voters are going for parties that want two currencies. They want the lira back and the euro. Now, look, Silvio Berlusconi is not exactly a man of high principle. So I suspect if the price of getting into power was abandoning his plan to bring back the lira, he would. But it's another sign of the potential instability in the European project.
Tectonic plates are in movement, yes, absolutely.
So if the European project is so unstable, why on earth are the Brexit negotiators not able to exploit this?
It's hard to exploit because, for one thing, Britain has its own agenda and she has 27 countries with whom to negotiate. They're not all bankrupt yet. They're in trouble and they have cracks and so forth. But there are still governments with which Britain has to get on. And we don't want to exploit because it's not in British interest to see the EU to fail. The EU failing would be totally detrimental to British interests. So they are crucially interested in maintaining stability in Europe, in Britain's forecourt. It's always been the main problem for British governments that the European forecourt is too restless and too dangerous.
Indeed, I think Britain would find it much easier in the Brexit negotiations if the European Union was successful. If the European Union had the self-confidence to say, oh, you guys don't want to join our club, that's fine, we understand, that would be much easier. Instead, they are very worried about the project fragmenting. Yeah. And that makes them take this hard line because it's a kind of understandable defensive posture. When you hear people on the European side say, well, this deal can't look good, otherwise lots of other people will want it. Now, I'm not sure that's true, but I mean that's that. And the other thing we haven't even touched on is the massive east-west split that is opening up in Europe. You look at the direction in which the Visegrad countries are going. You look at the language that Emmanuel Macron uses about the Polish government, for example. I mean, this is a very big challenge. And I think there's an interesting question for Germany here, which, you know, has successfully pursued this Ostpolitik. How does it balance out, you know, Emmanuel Macron on posted workers, on political rights, and his approach to Eastern Europe, and Germany's policy in its own near abroad?
Well, there are so many sort of countercurrents going on in Europe at the moment. It's like a riddle inside an enigma wrapped in a mystery, what you will say about the emerging Europe, as Churchill famously said about the old Soviet Union. And Macron, I mean, for me, Macron is the biggest question mark in all of this, because, as James said, he'll try to hold out the carrot for future burden sharing and debt sharing in Europe. That, for the French bloody-minded unions and others, is not enough of a temptation to really abandon their resistance to reform. I really want to see what is going to happen in France and with Macron's high notions of reforming France. Until I've seen that actually happening in the streets and the absence of civil war, look at how Hollande tried some minimum reforms in France, had to withdraw them as soon as the first sign of quote-unquote civil war appeared. France is an unpredictable country and I wouldn't want to be too close in cahoots with them unless they have proved that they are a modern society.
Thank you, James and Thomas.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
Next, Scandinavian countries have been amongst the most welcoming to refugees, but in Norway the rules are tightening. Sylvi Listhaug is Norway's immigration minister, leading a charge against economic migrants and rethinking their Norwegian position on refugees. She joined us at The Spectator, where she spoke to our editor, Fraser Nelson.
So Sylvi, over the last 4 years, Europe has had a profound demographic change that's affected most countries in Europe. How has Norway been affected and how does it compare to, say, your neighbour, Sweden?
Well, we have not had such a big influx as Sweden. They have had an extremely high influx, especially in 2015, with over 160,000 people.
How does that compare to Norway?
We had a little bit over 30,000, but that was three times a normal year. So we have had a lot of people coming also to us as asylum seekers. And we have also given shelter to people from the UNHCR in Norway mm-hmm. that are refugees and have had that status from the UN. Mm-hmm. So what we see is that we have a big challenge now in integrate all the people that have been given permission to stay in Norway.
And what about popular opinion? I mean, in Sweden, we've seen the rise of the Sweden Democrats, a party that's gone from obscurity to quite high in the opinion polls. In Germany, we've had Alternative for Deutschland, also driven by concerns about demographic change. In Norway, have you experienced the similar kind of political upheaval?
We have had Progress Party, Fremskrittspartiet, for a lot of years. Mm. And since the 80s, we have talked about the need to have a strict immigration policy, that we need to think about this in a long term, how Norway is going to be. We have to have regulations that don't make us so attractive because we're a rich land. Mm-hmm. We know that a lot of people would like to go to Norway to live there. So we have taken this role for a long time. But compared to the Swedish Democrats and the other parties, a lot of them are a socialist party, but against immigration. Mm-hmm. Fremskrittspartiet, we are a libertarian party, and we also want a stricter immigration policy because we see that's important for Norway in the long run.
And when it comes to your area, immigration and integration, what lessons can Norway offer the rest of Europe, do you think?
Well, we want to have a policy that doesn't make it attractive for people that are not in need of protection to go to Europe.
In other words, want to make it very unattractive for economic migrants.
Yeah, and on the other hand, we also know that it's 65 million people fleeing from war and mm-hmm. other problems. And we can help so many more of them in the areas nearby.
You mean giving helps in camps, yeah. for example, in Jordan or places like that?
Yeah. The money we spend on people coming to our societies mm-hmm. can help so many more out there.
So why do you think then, you've got Britain and you've got Norway who are taking this approach, taking in relatively few refugees, especially the child refugees, and spending quite a lot of money in places outside. But in the rest of Europe, this is still quite controversial. So what do you think it is about the way that Europe sees this problem, where the focus still is on accepting people here, even if it means that the resources you're going to spend on that mean you can help far fewer people out there?
Mm. There are interest groups, activists, others that, and also left side media, that runs single stories, difficult stories in the press to make people feel guilty. And of course, there are so many fantastic people coming to us. But if they are not in need of protection, we need to think about the big picture and what mm-hmm. signals we give. And I think it's a lot of the countries in Europe are thinking more like us. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a lot of the countries in Europe sees that we have to have this under control.
Right, because in Sweden, I think I'm right in saying that at least half of the immigrants are from countries like Afghanistan or, you know, countries where you're moving for poverty. Sure, I can understand why you'd want to go to a richer country. But you're saying that you will basically reject, what, any economic migrants?
Yeah, if you're an economic migrant, you are declined in Norway. We give protection for the ones that need that, mm-hmm. that are in danger in their own country. But we also have spent a lot of money to return people that are declined in Norway.
It must cost a lot of money flying everybody back to Afghanistan.
Yeah, but it's well worth it. Of course, the signals is almost the most important, that you see that if I'm in Afghanistan, I want a better life, I should not pay a smuggler to get me to Norway, because if I'm not in favor of protection, I will be sent back. And that's not the thing they want.
Sure. So would you say that Norway has got would you say it's got the toughest policy in Europe on economic migration?
I think when it comes to return policy, we mm-hmm. are one of the countries that have succeeded in sending people back. And now we see that other countries in Europe are also working hard on this. And that's good, because we need to send the message, all the countries, that mm-hmm. if you're not in need of protection, you will be sent back. Mm-hmm. And also to prevent a black labor market, people living under the surface, making crime, all those things that we know, that people staying without legal mm-hmm. matters, that's a big problem. And so I'm glad that other countries also are working hard on this now.
I guess you must be fairly used now to being called cruel and heartless. This is the accusation leveled against you. Is that a problem? How does it make you feel?
I don't give a damn. That's because I mean that this is the right thing to do. I mean that we should think about all refugees. We should do as much as we can for as many as possible. And then it's the wrong answer to have a policy that makes a lot of people without the need of protection coming to our countries as asylum seekers. And I also think that we have such a big task in the future to integrate people that has come into our values, to learn our language, to be able to earn their own money and stand on their own feet. So I think these are the issues that are important.
Is that the consensus in Norway?
No, it's a debate in Norway. Mm. But I think a lot of people think that this is the right way to go. And I think it's the sustainable way to go.
That was Fraser Nelson and Sylve Listhaug.
Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend.
And finally, eyes meeting across urinals, feet creeping under toilet stools. All across London, men are meeting in private for anonymous gay sex. Cottaging, as it's called, is a throwback to the days when homosexuality was illegal. But according to Tom Ball in this week's magazine, it is somehow managing to thrive in a world of gaydar and Grindr. Tom joins me now along with Graham Kirby, a writer and cottaging aficionado. So Tom, for the uninitiated, including me, can you just explain what cottaging actually is?
I should say that I'm also the uninitiated and I'm not a first-hand authority on this, and I've been talking to people like Graham and my local cottager.
Do you have like a local cottaging society?
Not a society as such, but there's a community, I'd say. There's a man that I see quite frequently down by the local cottage. And
when you say the local cottage, what is that actually?
So a cottage is public loo, so-called, because they slightly resemble cottages built in the 19th century.
Is there an original cottage?
I think the one on St. James's Park, just by here, actually.
Well, the park keeper's cottage.
I think that may be the original.
Oh my goodness, I thought that was such an innocent little place with herons and pelicans.
And cottaging is just the act of public sex in a public toilet.
And Graham, you are a cottager, not in the park keeper sense, but in the sense
in the
of this
initiated
article.
Sense.
In the initiated sense, yeah. Yes. Why?
Why?
Why would you do that?
Well, I think you know what you have to remember first of all is that cottaging has been going on for centuries since the Victorians came up with public toilets. A lot of gay men, gay and bisexual men, did not have anywhere to meet. There were no gay bars before decriminalisation, so it was an act of necessity. I think where it then gets interesting is when it moves from an act of necessity to maybe what you might call an obsession, an addiction, or something like that. You know, it is unlike, say, going into a gay bar, which you have to remember can be an intimidating experience for someone of any age, whether they're 18 or 48. Cottaging is an adventure into the unknown. See, I mean, you go into a public toilet, you have no idea what's going to be there.
Possibly a toilet.
Possibly a toilet. More probably, well, not more probably, equally likely there is, you know, going to be someone there who's looking for something similar to what you're looking for. I'm trying to think of these euphemisms now, sorry.
is cottaging against the law, Tom?
I think it is, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
So I mean, there's a thrill of getting caught. This is a sort of stolen fruit is always sweetest, isn't it, Graham?
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, there is a eroticism to risk. The actuality is, of course, slightly different. History shows, you know, lots of lives being ruined, essentially. You know, I mean, back in the Victorian times, you had penny dreadfuls, which are like little scandal sheets, say, like, maybe like the National Enquirer or something like that. They publicised cottaging by, you know, saying so-and-so was arrested, convicted, etc. So that sort of allowed people to sort of know what was going on, as it were.
And it continued to be part of celebrity culture until now.
Yeah, George Michael being the most obvious member of that list. In fact, there's actually now a Hampstead Heath festival that happens every year, which celebrates George Michael being caught in that particular public toilet.
And what happens at this festival?
As far as I can tell, I think it's just one big love-in.
Is it around the Hampstead Ponds, for instance?
Yeah.
Because that's featured in the Line of Beauty, which has a number of cottaging incidents. You expressed surprise in your article, Tom, that cottaging is still taking place because, firstly, it's obviously you can have sex as a gay man anywhere you want now. It doesn't have to be somewhere hidden. But you can also hook up over Grindr, Gaydar, a number of apps, rather than sort of lurking under a lamppost or hanging about near the urinals, which I have to say, I can understand perhaps the thrill of trying not to get caught, but a toilet doesn't sound very sexy, let's face it.
Well, I think there's a certain pleasure in the seediness of it. It's like going to a strip bar. I think only half the pleasure is actually seeing someone strip. The other half is sort of the revelry of the underbelly and sort of being in this quite horrible place. As Graham said, there's a sort of forbidden fruit eroticism to it. And it's the turn-on of misdemeanor and danger and the fact that you can be caught at any moment and the fact that this could, you know, potentially ruin your life.
There is also, I mean, this is both true online and offline, a huge amount of sort of social transgression involved in it, cottaging in several ways. You know, once again, if you look back at sort of the 1920s, 30s, you know, you very often see arrests of, so to say, middle-class men, maybe in their 40s or 50s, but they're dressed as working-class men. You know, they have their cloth cap on, you know, whatever. So there is that element of sort of being someone different. So very famously, or at least amongst gay men, John Gielgud, who was arrested for cottaging in 1953, he was wearing his cloth cap. And so I think, you know, in gay sort of sexual fantasy, there is a lot of role-playing, a lot of sort of assuming identities.
And Tom, we've obviously talked about gay and bisexual men cottaging. Have you come across any lesbian cottagers or straight cottagers, or is it a manly thing?
I haven't personally, no. I suspect that it doesn't go on necessarily between straight people. Purely the practicality of having a mixed toilet might be an issue.
Yeah.
This is a good point. What about women cottaging?
Women cottaging, I don't know of. I'm sure it's personally possible.
I do remember a few years ago that there was some talk that a group of lesbians had tried to initiate a women's only section of Hampstead Heath as a cruising.
Because there is a ladies' pond.
There's a ladies' pond, yeah. Yes. But there is, you know, I think, you know, they tried to sort of initiate it amongst sort of, you know, gay women, but it just never took off.
Now, how did the HIV/AIDS crisis of the 1980s change the cottaging scene? We've mentioned the Line of Beauty, which obviously culminates in the discovery of AIDS as part of that book. What changed the culture there?
What you see in the 1980s with the advent of HIV and AIDS is, especially in this country and in America, is a massive moral backlash against gay men. You see arrests going up. You see entrapment going up. You know, the pretty policeman, a police officer dressed in tight jeans, lurking around a public toilet, waiting for someone to come in, trying to get them to expose themselves in some way. So all that goes up. And there is an unfortunate and inaccurate association between HIV and AIDS and cottaging. You know, most of the practices that would go on in a cottage are not going to be spreading HIV and AIDS, if I can put it delicately.
I'm just going to challenge you further in terms of your euphemisms and delicate language. You're saying that cottaging doesn't tend to be penetrative sex?
Yes. Obviously, it happens, but it is, you know, not necessarily the norm.
And just finally, Tom, for those who may appreciate that this is a very exciting activity and there's a thrill to it, but don't necessarily want to sort of encounter it themselves accidentally when on a day out, in the same way as I don't particularly appreciate my friends telling me about their sex lives, are there any notorious cottages that a prudish spectator reader might wish to avoid?
Well, I think
to visit, perhaps?
I think the one on St. James's Park is still quite active. Clapham Common are certainly, I mean, the commons in general tend to be the most active cottages because I think they're more secluded and more difficult to get to, and people tend to avoid them at night time anyway.
Any tips, Graham?
I think there's a certain sort of, let's say, cottages code would sort of preclude me from telling where the best places are.
A gentleman never tells.
Unfortunately, the days when sort of public toilets used to stay open late and all sorts of exciting things would happen there late at night are long gone, though.
The dark side of council cuts,
yes.
Limited cottaging opportunities.
Yeah. The most terrible thing about austerity is the lack of cottaging.
Thanks, Tom and Graham. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Americano, our look at American politics, hosted by Freddie Gray. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on the podcast, as well as great pieces by Brendan O'Neill, Damian Thompson and Deborah Ross. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.